Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
This is the Mondo Wise Podcast. I'm Dave Reed. Last month, Frank Barat spoke with Nora Ericott on our new YouTube show, Witnessing Palestine. As we recorded that program, Gaza had been under Israeli bombardment from the air, land, and sea for 70 days. At that time, 18,000 Palestinians in Gaza were known to have been killed by the Israeli military. Today, that number is over 28,000. More than 68,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been wounded. The Israeli military continues to invade Palestinian cities and villages in the West Bank. Violent attacks on Palestinians by Israeli settlers also continue. Nora joined Frank to discuss the collective trauma of Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza and where the global movement for Palestinian freedom goes from here. Nora is a human rights attorney and an associate professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Africana Studies and the Program in Criminal Justice. She is an editorial committee member of the Journal for Palestine Studies and a co-founding editor of Jadalia.
I've been wanting to talk to you for a few weeks. You know that we've been in touch on WhatsApp and stuff. And obviously we're not like a news media. I'm not a news media. I want to talk to you more about what do we do as people, as activists, as human beings when we're faced with, in a way, collective trauma, grief, and anger. You know, how do we not crumble? You said recently, I think, to a group of students, we wake up and we're not sure what today is going to be like. And that's why a lot of us have been feeling in the last few weeks. You don't even want to switch on the news because you're worried another hospital would have been bombed, another 1,000 kids would have been dead, killed. So how do we keep going as human beings in front of such collective trauma and grief?
Yeah, that's a wonderful way to open, and a very, I think, vulnerable way to open. In my reference, every night I sleep in the same way, or I attempt to sleep in the same way, which is deep, deep prayer, right? The willing and the faith that in the morning there will be a ceasefire, my time, right? And I have turned in this moment, as a very secular human, I've turned to lots of prayer to be able to fill the gaps of this grief and to be able to fill the gaps in the ineptitude of leadership and the institutions that should have made this moment impossible, unfathomable. And when I wake up in the morning and do not find that there is a ceasefire, oftentimes there's a mix, right? I'm always going to turn on the news. It's not the trepidation to do that, but really the feeling is inside of me. My spirit has fluctuated and has not been the same, and I think a lot of Palestinians have answered the question when people ask them, how are they? You know, I've answered that question to other Palestinians as, I'm exactly like you. And I've answered the question to, almost everyone else by explaining every day is different. Today I am, and fill in the blank. And so on some days, like the day before yesterday, I had an unprecedented feeling of energy and fight. It was a wonderful feeling. I haven't had that feeling probably in those 68 days that preceded it. And I wanted to hold on to it, thinking maybe this would last. I had the energy to pick up all the phone calls and to run and to multitask and to do the interview and jump on to the email and then take the emergency phone call. And then yesterday, I didn't feel like that. Yesterday, I was devastated and I was strung together by a panic attack. Just, I was on the edge of a panic attack all day, so that I didn't even have the patience to be as kind as I would like to in my interactions and responses. Because every request just felt like the end of me. because what if I could not respond adequately? And today is yet to be seen. I've started already and taken phone calls and responded to the crises and tried to write, but you know, there's a way in which I haven't figured out yet if this is going to be good or bad. How is it that we get by? My instinct tells me, and I imagine this is how other people feel that I've spoken to. My instinct every day tells me to hide, and I have hidden for a long time. I've self-isolated. You know, people who want to hang out, I'm almost annoyed. I'm like, to do what? Unless you want to watch the news together or to work together. You know what I mean? And my instinct is to retreat. And yet it's precisely in fighting that instinct in which I've developed the energy and cultivated in order to continue. It's precisely when I've agreed, you know, to come out into a home where friends have gathered in collective prayer and grief that I felt better. It's precisely when I see other people who are also holding grief so that we can hold it together that I feel better. It's precisely when I've gone to the poetry reading for Palestine, where when I walked into the room, I hid all the way in the back because I couldn't stomach looking at anybody in the eye. That by the end of that reading, I felt that the words and the collective energy in that room massaged a spiritual knot that gave me enough energy to go on for maybe two more days. So, yeah, I think, Frank, my advice is, you know, generically, we tell people we're all we got, we have to survive. And yet in these moments of extreme, extenuating, grotesque circumstances, the hardest thing to do is to be with one another and to expand our capacity for, you know, that collective moment, as opposed to working for another 5 hours incessantly on something that I have found that's given me enough energy to go on maybe 2 to 3 days, if I'm lucky, 5 days before that spiritual resolve dissolves once again.
In a way, like, do you try to hold on to the beauty? I don't know if you know what I mean, but that's what what we're experiencing is horrible. I've never experienced anything like this in my life. You know, I've followed Palestine for 15, 20 years, and there's a moment of a breakdown. I feel I've been, in a way, on the verge of tears for about 8 weeks now. It's always fighting. You know, what do you keep above, or do you stay above, or do you go down, you know? But, I mean, I live in Brussels. I've met over the last 8 weeks, 200 people I didn't know 8 weeks ago, people from all walks of life that have stopped everything. And I think if we don't hold to this beauty, we crumble. But do you know what I mean?
No, absolutely. Listen, one, I want to point out two things in what you said. Number two, and you said you've never experienced this. I just want to emphasize this is a collective human catastrophe. Yes, it hits far deeper for Palestinians who are literally being subject to a genocide and whose very existence, which was, you know, always expressed by the right wing as the existential threat, as the threat to the world, as the problem that needed to be solved, is now on the top level of the agenda across mainstream media, government, and even university administrations, right? But this is a human experience. One, you know, you described 200 people that have stopped everything. It does remind me of the moment, you know, that the same way that in its international nature, the pandemic of COVID made us all experience the same thing. Palestine is actually sustaining a collective global experience for us in an unprecedented way in this moment. And it's heightened by the fact that technological advancements make it such that we are literally witnessing the grotesque nature, not just the metaphorical, the hypothetical, right? But the literal grotesque nature of genocidal violence and the colonial order that sustains it. So yeah, in these moments, the beauty is in the promise and the resolve, right? The beauty for me, I've seen many, many times. It was, I forget her name, and if she sees this, forgive me. I apologize to you if you're watching this. The NYU law student who single-handedly made the entire administration tremble and then refused to back down. She was so filled with this sense of truth. She's not Palestinian. She was so imbued with this sense of truth nonetheless, and the threats that came with it and that, you know, national attacks, that she came onto Democracy Now and held strong. Wow. Mm-hmm. What beauty did I see in that humanity and what humans are capable of? What beauty in the incessant and brave and unprecedented offering of Palestinian journalists like Wael Dahdouh, whose wife and children were killed and who stood in front of the camera to continue in that duty. What strength there. Or from Mu'taz and Bisan and Saleh and Plastia, who frankly are, you know, just above being children. They barely cross the threshold of childhood. They're in their 20s. What are other people doing in their 20s, right? And yet, in that moment, right, Plastia finds, you know, is gifted a turtle from an elder woman who gives it to her, and she rejoices in that turtle. In that moment, she plays Uno with a number of Palestinian children sipping tea in a tent. And it's that, you know, our commitment to fighting is first and foremost a commitment to life. And to witness that commitment in that way is very beautiful, is precisely what sustains us and what has made us evolve, I hope, for the better as humanity or parts of humanity. Yeah. I mean, we'll get into that. I think that humanity is a false construct at this point. Yeah. But, you know, in those things that so many of us consider as the most essential things that make us alive. Yeah.
Thanks, Noura. I mentioned, like, when I started, like, the journey, the path that we all embarked on, you know, other people with a capital P have experienced genocides, have experienced ethnic cleansing before.
Exactly.
I was wondering, what do you see as the most useful lessons from indigenous thinkers and indigenous movements at this time?
Thank you. So I want to lift up that in addition to indigenous peoples who have endured many stages of genocide, right? An apocalypse, right? This world shattered. Like, we can talk about the loss of life, but there's a loss of life in which, you know, you have a world to continue in. And then there's a loss of life, as in this moment, where nothing, right, around you, your world is shattered. Your streets, your homes, your schools, your places of worship, your community gatherings, corners that mark memories, right? Even relationships with one another that have been shattered, that this is apocalyptic in that sense. And beyond indigenous peoples who have endured this apocalypse, Palestinians endured it at least twice in 48 and 67, right? You know, some might say even in 82 after the invasion of Lebanon, but the apocalypse of African descendant peoples who have been kidnapped and enslaved, their lives ripped apart repeatedly every single day in the prevention of even being able to sustain family, as families were turned into isolated, alienable property.
Yeah.
And Jewish life and the apocalypse that was experienced in the Holocaust. Also a memory of apocalypse that has animated, you know, the descendants of those Jews in particular in many different directions. Some have been animated in order to make sure it never happens again because they know it, and others have been animated to make sure it doesn't happen again to them, even if the rest of the world, as they know it, becomes more dangerous. So what do we learn from indigenous scholars? I mean, which ones and how? I have particularly lifted up and mentioned Audra Simpson, Nick Estes, who is a dear friend, Maya Mikdashi, Irana Barakat is an indigenous, Palestinian indigenous scholar. Maya is a Lebanese, Ojibwe indigenous scholar. I want to lift up Glenn Coulthard, who has taught me much. And just in those limited readings, what we get is a few things. And one is an insistence that we live on a continuum of settler time that renders an indigenous peoples to a past, right? To some past that we can never go back to, and almost freezes indigenous people not only to the past, but also, you know, freezes them in a moment of time that then counts against them if they evolve as communities. You're not as indigenous.
Yeah.
If you're not necessarily on the land or you've evolved in different ways. So one is a rejection of settler time. But that indigenous time continues that disrupts that, right? Another is the concept that Noor Jouda, as a Palestinian indigenous scholar, gives us in her study of Hawaii and Palestine, of geography, of place. So many of the places that we know are also settler places, settler geography, that very thinly veils indigenous knowledge, right? Right before it, around it, on it, we're on it. Another is the concept of indigenous sovereignty, that the concept of sovereignty that we have learned, you know, very traditionally, especially enshrined in international law, is a concept of sovereignty that ties self-governance and self-determination to territory and statehood. Whereas, right, Audra Simpson reminds us that there are these concepts of nested sovereignty. We're like the Mohawk Nation that straddles a settler border between the United States and Canada. They actually are their settler sovereignty within their bodies as they travel with it, as they sustain it together. Another concept is a refusal, a politics of refusal and a demand for non-recognition, like Glenn Coulthard, who has shown us that recognition by the settler sovereign is actually a trap. That U.S. recognition of indigenous nations, and this echoes the work of Edom Katachu and John Reynolds, you know, of repressive inclusion, that inclusion in these frameworks, in these settler frameworks, doesn't necessarily make us stronger, right? And the PLO has fallen into that trap. But that the inclusion of these frameworks actually just traps us in somebody else's concept of life. The last one that I'll share is Indigenous Resurgence. Indigenous Resurgence, and this is the work of John Korntassel, who points out that similar to this idea of nested sovereignty, that resurgence in one's community when we turn away from the settler sovereign and actually work on our own community, that we are doing the work of decolonization because we are building for the life after, right? We are building for the life, you know, we are planting the seeds, and from these seeds grows the life that we want, rather than just continuously focusing on our settler sovereign, the colonial domination that we want to remove. Lessons are abundant. And I encourage those, all of us, I encourage all of us, especially those who live as settlers, as I do, on stolen lands, to not fetishize indigenous histories and struggles in communities, but to engage with them in a way that reflects an ethical solidarity in moving forward. Because the struggle for Palestine is a struggle for all indigenous peoples. The struggle for Palestine is a struggle against all colonization and against all racial domination. And that has to be true everywhere and not just in one place.
I'm glad you actually mentioned a common friend, John Reynolds, because he's the one, I spoke to him today, and he said, ask Noora about indigenous lessons and stuff. So
that was his question.
Yeah, that was his question.
You know, John and I, and you know, John is Irish.
Yeah, I know.
And I always joke that when we went to Dublin to share the book talk was the first time I was in Europe and I didn't feel like I was in white society. Interestingly. I mean, I think Irish identity and whiteness shifts, right, from the United States and in Ireland. So it's, you know, and it also reflects race as a construct, as a social construction. But the other thing about John is he and I have been working on a book project together, the provisional title of which was Confronting Zionism, Dismantling the Apartheid of Our Time, taking on the reticence of those who described Israel as overseeing an apartheid regime, from actually grappling with the Zionist ideology that actually drives, right, genocidal expansion and territorial consolidation.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've been thinking about this, for quite some time. And now we're in a moment where, you know, we've been going back. What happens now with this project? Because the terms have shifted so fast, so radically, in such revolutionary ways, right? That even though the discussion of racism and racial colonialism more specifically, which is apartheid is a racial colonial structure. You know, it's been domesticated in international law as a concept, but it is a racial colonial structure. It's global in its dimension. Even though genocide would not have been possible without the thorough dehumanization that that racial colonialism actually facilitated, right? How could you have possibly embarked on this genocidal campaign if there wasn't already a priming that Palestinians didn't deserve to live, or somehow that if they do, it's a privilege, yeah, and that they have to somehow sign a contract of being good natives in order to live? I mean, that's literally what they have been told, which makes this moment possible. And yet, you know, this moment does that conversation almost feel too far away now? Yeah. So just something that we've been thinking about.
Sounds great. I mean, John and yourself, and I'm going to move to a more, because I know you're in high demand. I don't want to keep you for 4 hours, because we could actually talk for about 4 hours.
And we have, haven't we, Fred? In Belgium. Yes.
John and yourself also legal scholars. And I wanted to ask you something, because what's been happening forever with Palestine from Operation Cat's Lead in 2009 until now is people looking at legal institutions, the ICJ, the ICC, domestic courts, to actually, in a way, break the impunity of Israeli generals and politicians. But you've recently also said that institutions, including legal institutions, have been structures in our domination, talking about the domination of the Palestinian people. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, no, I think it's really confusing because I'm trained as a human rights attorney. That's my experience before I entered the academy. It continues to be the subject of a big part of my own research. And so I think it's very confusing to general audiences who look to me like, you're a lawyer and you have a hammer, go find a nail. You know, this is George Bicharat, who actually is a mentor and taught me at one point. And his reprieve that lawyers are given hammers, and so they look for nails everywhere. And yet, one of the things that I've learned in my own work and my own experience and research is that the law works against us, right? And I say in my book, law is power. Law is power. And to the extent that it could be used in the service of emancipatory struggles, it has to be done so on behalf of very strategic political campaigns, not the other way around, right? Because if law is power, then our primary concern needs to be power. How do we grow it? What do we make of it? And in that context, we can use the law merely as a tactic, but not as a strategy. And so I think that, and I trace this history for 100 years between 1917 and 2017, and in fact show that Israel has used international law far more to its advantage than Palestinians have. Obviously, this is a reflection of power as well, but it's also a reflection of that strategic appreciation. In this moment, we're seeing something very similar, where there is this mobilization to use, especially amongst the legal professionals for whom I have a tremendous amount of respect, notwithstanding this possible strategic disagreement, you know, to find all the small legal mechanisms in which to enter at the UN and beyond, the petitions and so on and so forth. And my thought has been since 2014, at least, when Palestine began to discuss its accession to the Rome Statute that would have made it a member of the ICC, of which now it is, and it's recognized, that we should never believe that these institutions are going to work in our favor, right? That these very institutions, by their nature, even looking at the document that established the ICC, the 1998 Rome Statute, in the words of scholar Kamari Maxine Clark, enshrines white supremacy. Of the core crimes that can be prosecuted, colonialism is not one of them. The fact that there's a temporal limit on what can be prosecuted means that all colonial atrocities are beyond actual prosecution. The fact that there's a complementarity clause which stipulates that the first right of jurisdiction goes to a national court before it becomes the ICC's jurisdiction means that the most advanced states will probably never have to appear in the court if they have the means and the will to prosecute themselves. I can go on and on, but we know this from the text. And now we know this from experience that since the ICC has been established, it's only indicted Arab and African heads of state and accused, you know, with the exception of Slobodan Milosevic and now the arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin. So knowing this, how is it? And I was part of a team that actually filed an ICC petition. So that's really a contradiction, right? But how is it that we appreciate this possibility and still use these tools? Well, the way that I use this with my team is to agitate. We use that as an entry point in order to create the controversy that now needed to be addressed. Now it became a top line media question. Now we can actually make, and we could before without the petition, but the petition certainly helped. But that gave us the platform and the opportunity to make our charges,
yeah,
and to call for arrest warrants even before we appear in court, which is probably not going to happen anytime soon. Karim Khan, the prosecutor, has already visited Israeli families who are survivors of the October 7th operation, the attacks, and already concluded that likely Hamas committed war crimes. And yet it took 6 years between 2015 and 2021 for the ICC to decide that Palestine does have jurisdiction after it acceded. And the investigation has been open for 2 years since 2021. And Khan has not spoken to any Palestinians in Gaza, despite the fact that this is not the first large-scale offensive onslaught that they've been subjected to. And consider that just earlier this year, in February, 35 Palestinian human rights organizations approached Khan because the beginning of this year, as you remember, Frank, was promised to be the deadliest year in Palestinian history since 2005. And so approached the prosecutor with that appeal in February. And yet here we are in the midst of genocide with this legacy. And where is Karim Khan? So one way to see that is to be horribly disappointed and to give up, right? We've done everything we can. We've mobilized. We've held marches in the millions. We've sustained this charge of genocide. And yet here we are. One way to respond to that is to just give up. That's really disheartening. And it occurred to me, and this is why I shared what you're sharing there, that I wanted to remind folks that we actually won. We actually have already achieved what this genocide convention enabled us to do, which is to name this atrocity. In Guernica, the city has already blared the siren warning of genocide. Every time there's a march chanting ceasefire now and free Palestine, that is a siren of genocide. And that we should not take the collusion of these international legal institutions which sustain white supremacy and the supremacy of a Western colonial order as somehow a mark of our failure, but actually just as part of the struggle. And that's how we need to continue to be strategic against them. To win, to actually win in this demonstrating genocide outside of the courtroom, because genocide was committed and genocide was immoral even before it was proscribed in the 1948 in the Genocide Convention. Does the absence of a convention mean it didn't happen? Does the absence of a ruling mean it didn't happen? Of course not. Of course not. So do not put our faith in those institutions that are not there to protect us in the first place. And to the extent that we use those institutions, we need to do so with a healthy dose of skepticism and very strategically, and how we're going to move, all with the intent of building power, which is why, Frank, one of the things you and I worked on was very useful in this regard. You spearheaded, right? You organized the Russell Tribunal on Palestine in four different locations that found that the U.S. was a pillar in Israel's apartheid, prolonged occupation, the usurpation of self-determination, the violation of these peremptory norms. You were part, you know, the one in South Africa that found that Israel practiced apartheid in 2013, right? Years before the International Human Rights Legacy Organizations caught up to it. And frankly, years after, decades after, Palestinian intellectuals and organizers and activists and revolutionaries and fighters had demonstrated the same thing. So we continue that legacy.
Last question, Noura. You've partly responded. I remember, again, I go back to Operation Cat's Lead because on a personal level, it felt like a moment that will change everything. You know, I remember talking to activists and legal scholars, and, you know, this moment's going to change everything. Israel's gone too far. Israel shot itself in the foot. But then we went back to normal in a way, right? And then there was another one in 2012 and in 2014 and in the massacres in Gaza, like, you know, there's so many of them. So I don't know how you feel, but I feel like this one, I just feel it inside. I feel it in my body, in my vein, that this one does changes everything. Something's changed. The fact that we can talk about genocide. I mean, the Russell Tribunal within New York, we wanted to address genocide, but then a lot of people said, no, we can't talk about genocide. Let's talk about sociocide. But now we talk about genocide openly, you know. So in a way, my question is, does this moment change everything? Or how do we make sure it does change everything?
I think the latter question is actually the most apt one. Here's the thing. I agree with you. It certainly changes everything. The question is, how do we define time and change? Right? Is it an immediate change or not? And so, yeah, in my estimation, unfortunately, what we're seeing, we're about to see something much worse in Palestine, as we see against the Palestinian citizens of the state who can't even like posts. They can't even like posts on social media without being fired or arrested. Or the Palestinians in East Jerusalem who are now being subject to cleansing, where the settlers are being armed and transformed to an explicit paramilitary unit. Or in Gaza, where Israel is planting flags along the shore of Palestinian cities. Or in the United States or across European geographies, where structures of repression are actually now just taking shape that are criminalizing Intifada. From the river to the sea. Free Palestine. There was a podcast that literally tried to liken Free Palestine to Hail Hitler. My God. For us, this is so absurd, but it's also the beginning, I think, of a much worse moment to come in terms of our repression. And so we need to prepare for that. And not to be disheartened by that either. But that tightening that I think is on the horizon, that violence, that crude coercive force that's on the horizon, that's far more crude even than what we've seen, is an indication of the absolute failure of the moral authority of Zionism. That if there was an argument to be made that now it lacks moral authority that can sustain it, and instead it's outright coercive force, to the point where Zionists in the United States, who are a minority and have the most to lose through clamping down on free speech, are advocating for clamping down on free speech, right? They are working against their own interests. They are strengthening a police state that will not just attack Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples, but that will attack everybody. And so those of us who are paying attention know that, the critical amongst us know that, the people who are not speaking precisely because they know that. And they're afraid of this repression. But what it also indicates is that there is a common understanding that there is a lid being placed on. And a lid placed on that much pressure cannot be maintained. Impossible. Impossible. So, of course, nothing will be the same, right? The question is, how do we define that time and define that change? I've placed it in the locus of a generation that has similarly identified that adults have failed them, have betrayed them on issues of climate, gun control, racial justice, the protection of transgender life, on gender justice. These people, you know, 18 to 35, but also much younger, who aren't counted amongst the constituents who are being polled, are the future. Are the future. There is no way the universe they create after experiencing this moment looks like the universe we live in now. It's impossible. It's impossible. And so that's where I see this change coming about. I see it as being generational. I see it as being iterative. I see it as also being preceded by a tremendous more amount of pressure and repression than we've experienced so far. And I just encourage folks to continue to take care of one another, to continue in the legacies that we have learned, especially during COVID, where folks learned to take care of one another in the failure of government and in government betrayal, especially in the moment of Black uprising, where abolition became mainstreamed almost in a matter of weeks, to think about what does it mean, right? In the words of Ruth Wilson Gilmore and also Miriam Kaba, this concept of creating life-affirming conditions. Life-affirming conditions. And so that's where I'm at on this. And I encourage us all to keep faith and not to lose it.
Thank you so much, Noura. I hope you know how much I appreciate you. I'd love to hug you, but I'll send you a virtual hug.
Yeah, I'm smiling real hard so I don't cry. You know, if you smile really hard, you just push back. This is a very, you said earlier, you're on the brink of tears. I mean, I cry at any given moment. I'll be fine. I'll be walking to pick up my daughter from somewhere and I'll just cry. This is just where we're at. This is just where we're at. And I think that that's wonderful because it means we're human still.
Love you, Noura.
Thank you, Frank. Love you too.
That's our show. Mondo Weiss is a nonprofit publication with no paywalls. If you would like to support our work, please go to mondoweiss.net/donate. Please leave a rating and review to help other listeners find the show. Subscribe to one of our free email newsletters so you can stay up to date on events in Palestine and related politics here in the U.S. and around the world. Finally, if you have any more feedback, send me an email at dave@mondoweiss.net. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with a new episode.
We begin today's show in Gaza, where Palestinian health officials say at least 16 children have died in recent days from starvation and dehydration as Israel's assault continues. UNICEF warns a number of child deaths will likely rapidly increase unless the war ends. Palestinians in Rafah searched Sunday under the rubble of a family home hit by an Israeli airstrike the night before that killed as many as 14 people, including a father and twin babies born in the last few months.
We want the United States to get away from us. We don't want anything from them. We don't want anything from the United States. They are lying and conspiring against us. God is my suffice and the best deputy.
Here in the United States, Vice President Kamala Harris Sunday called for a ceasefire in Gaza. She made the comments in a speech in Selma, Alabama, marking the 59th anniversary of Bloody Sunday.
And given the immense scale of suffering in Gaza, there must be an immediate ceasefire. Yeah! For at least the next 6 weeks, which is what is currently on the table. This will get the hostages out and get a significant amount of aid in. This would allow us to build something more enduring, to ensure Israel is secure, and to respect the right of the Palestinian people to dignity, freedom, and self-determination. Hamas claims it wants a ceasefire. Well, there is a deal on the table. And as we have said,
Hamas needs to agree to that deal. Let's get a ceasefire. Let's reunite the hostages with their families. And let's provide immediate relief to the people of Gaza.
Vice President Harris spoke 3 days after the United States blocked a UN Security Council statement condemning Israel after Israeli soldiers opened fire on Palestinians seeking aid in Gaza City in a massacre that left at least 118 people dead. On Sunday, officials in Gaza accused Israeli forces of killing and wounding dozens more aid seekers who'd gathered at the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza City. Facing growing international criticism, President Biden Friday announced the United States would begin airdropping food aid into Gaza. Negotiations for a temporary ceasefire faced another setback Sunday when Israel boycotted talks in Cairo after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Hamas of failing to provide a list of all living Israeli hostages. Meanwhile, Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz is in the U.S. for what's being described as an unauthorized trip to hold talks with Vice President Harris, Tony Blinken, and other top officials. Gantz is seen as a rival to Netanyahu, who reportedly lashed out at Gantz for making the trip without his approval. All of this comes as the official death toll in Gaza has topped 30,500. For more, we go to Rafah for an update from Akram al-Sattari, the Gaza-based journalist. Akram, your brother was at the aid convoy when Israeli soldiers opened fire. What did he explain to you happened, what's being now called the flour massacre, for the flour that people were coming to get to make bread?
Good morning, Amy. Yes, indeed, my brother was one of the people who were targeted by the Israeli tanks and artillery fire in that area of Al-Rashid Street, particularly Annabulsi roundabout, when they were trying to seek food for their children. To start with, it is the very personal story of my brother and mine, who was in direct contact with me, seeking to secure any help whatsoever for his children. He was taking that unsafe trip towards Annabulsi roundabout. He was waiting there. He was waiting from 3 in the afternoon. He was hoping that he would get at least some wheat flour for his children, because they have not eaten bread for around 25 days or even more than 25 days. He saw many people there coming from the Gaza north as well, in the hope that they can secure some food for their children. All of a sudden, the bombardment started. Not the bombardment, rather the tanks, gun fire started. And of course, the tanks are using 1.5 millimeter caliber guns, and those guns are very lethal. They can split a person into two halves. The fire started. The tanks never stopped shooting at them. And the observation that was made by the people who were there, including my brother, that the number of the tanks that were present in that particular time was in the sense that in the last few days, those tanks were like there, but not in the large number that was in that particular day. The fire started. The fire never stopped. People were shot. People were falling on the ground. People were running. And some of the wounded people were grabbing the legs of the other people, asking them to save and help them. The ones even whose legs were pulled were shot as well and were killed. So people were crawling. My brother told me that he was crawling for around 1.5 kilometers from this Annabulsi roundabout up to Ashalihat roundabout, which is an area that is around 1 kilometer or 1.2 kilometer a far way from the area that they were in. The firing never stopped, and to him, it looked like that was pre-planned, and that the massacre that was planned, according to the description of my brother and any other people, was intentional, and the firing never stopped till that very large number of people were killed. And a very large number of people also was injured. Some of them are dying every day. And this specific incident was replicated the day after this massacre took place, and the day, 3 days or even 4 days after that. So it looks like this is a policy that is followed by the Israeli occupation army, and it looks like the objective is to continue the starvation of the people of Gaza and to kill them when they dare to think that they can secure something to feed their children. So they were killed when they're trying to get the wheat flour. They were killed while they were seeking life.
So the Israeli military says it started a preliminary review and that Israeli forces did not attack the convoy, but that most of the fatalities were caused by a stampede. At the same time, the director of Al-Auda Hospital told the United Nations some 80% of the wounded brought into the hospital had been shot. If you could respond further, Akram.
Well, according to the preliminary diagnosis of the hospital and of the people who were there, most of the people who were there were suffering from upper body parts injuries, which is indicative of the gun that was used, of the fire that was used against them. Some of were hit also by shrapnel because of the artillery fire that was hit at them. Of course, if I were Israel, if I were the occupation, I would tell the world that I have already started a preliminary investigation, and they might also came from Mars and shot the Palestinians who were not using any arms and who were seeking to feed their children. That's typical. That's normal. This is the Israeli habit. They will say, because they targeted the Baptist hospital, and they also said that was not them. That was an Islamic Jihad rocket, a missile that hit the people and killed around 600 people. That's normal. But the issue now, if the international community is failing to compel Israel to conduct a scrutiny into the things that happened, I think the international community failed before and is still failing to stop the ongoing atrocities and is helping somehow when they're condoning the ongoing bombardment. They are failing to do justice for the people of Palestine, and they are failing to observe the international humanitarian law coordinates, international humanitarian law dictates that allow, that asks the government to take whatever precautions are needed to protect the civilian population that is living in Gaza, extremely difficult conditions, food. They're not living in a fire exchange. They are seeking food for their families and for their children and for themselves, and they ended up being killed. So Israel will deny, and I wouldn't be surprised to also if Israel said that they were killed by other Palestinians. That is a scenario I think that is extremely acceptable for Israel, and Israel allies would buy anything from Israel. So no need. The ones who were killed are just Palestinians. Palestinians who were treated as second grade humans, who are still besieged, who are still starving, who are still killed, who are still displaced for around six or seven or eight times, and who are expecting more of the misery and the death and displacement. So the international community is failing, and I don't think the Palestinians trust any statements made by the Israeli army about any preliminary investigation, because there were many preliminary investigations to be done, but they were never done, and there was many justice that is expected to be done for the Palestinians, but was not done.
Akram, if you can comment on the United States working with the Jordanian Air Force, dropping 38,000 ready-to-eat meals, largely on the beach in Gaza. If you can respond to, we just played clips of mass protest, that there was protest around the world, but one person in Washington, D.C. Commented on the fact that while the U.S. is dropping this food, they should stop providing Israel with the bombs they drop on Palestinians.
The clear analysis of this situation when it comes to the cause and effect relationship between Israel and the misery that the Palestinians have been living, United States and the misery that the Palestinians have been living, three C-103 planes were dropping food on the Palestinians, while countless number of F-16s, F-15s, F-22s, and F-35s, also with the most advanced technology and with the ammunition that are provided by the United States to the Israel. So in one hand, they are providing people with food, and on the other hand, they are providing people with death, taking their lives. I think the United States should be reconsidering its position when it comes to providing Israel with killing ammunitions and thinking that they are providing people in Gaza with around 35,000 or 36,000 meals that are ready to eat. The Palestinians might not be able to eat them. And some of the airdropped assistance that was dropped in Gaza went to the sea. And one of the people that I was talking to, he was joking and mocking the whole situation we are living in. He was saying the fish is very grateful for the American administration because they dropped the food that was sent to Gaza to the fish in the Gaza Sea. And I think a president that is dropping the aid for the Ukrainians while the Gaza is the target is in a way needs to reconsider everything about that, and they need to make sure that they provide unhindered access through the recognized crossings of Gaza for the people who are displaced in the Gaza South, south and in the Gaza North. So it's somehow, it's Palestinians find it ridiculous. Palestinians find it a way that needs to be reviewed and changed.
What word are you getting of ceasefire negotiations? And also, what is happening on the ground where you are in Rafah right now? Al Jazeera reporting at least 11 were killed, 50 wounded after an Israeli air attack on a tent housing displaced people next to an entrance to a hospital in Rafah City, not far from where you are standing.
Well, the negotiations are still underway. It looks like Israel has some demands to make. Some of them were not agreed upon in the past, but now they are coming up with them. Palestinians don't have high expectations when it comes to the negotiation. Palestinians are extremely busy now trying to survive because of the expansion of the ground operation in Khan Yunis area. They have already targeted, the Israel occupation targeted Hamad city area and also the Al-Gharara area, which is an expansion of the ground operation that has been already starting in Khan Yunis for the last, have been already rolling in Khan Yunis for the last 3 months. The Israeli occupation forces targeted a tent by a hospital in the Rafah west area, and they also targeted a home. The number of people who are killed in Rafah for the last 24 hours is more than 50 people in different incidents taking place in different parts of Rafah. So the misery is continuous and the bombardment is continuous, and the number of Palestinians who are killed because of that and the number of people who are displaced because of that is increasing, I would say, by the second, not by the minute.
Finally, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, has the negotiating team boycotting the negotiations now in the ceasefire negotiations in Cairo because he says Hamas has refused as part of the deal to provide the list of living hostages. Your thoughts on this and where these negotiations stand?
As a matter of fact, that I've been following the news about this from the Israeli media sources and from the Palestinian media sources as well. That specific request was not made by the Israeli security forces or security agencies in the past. Now Netanyahu is inventing something new for the sake of just continuing the delay. It looks like this delay is taking place for some purely political reasons, where Netanyahu is interested in prolonging the war. They have disputes, they have issues. One of the top leaders is now in the USA. Netanyahu is busy calling the Blinken and calling other people, telling them that it is an unauthorized trip. It looks like there's something that is internally happening in the Israeli political arena that Netanyahu wants to stop and prevent from happening. And that's why everything that he wants to do eventually reflects on the Palestinians. Now more killing, more displacement, now refusing the request to provide some names, now asking to provide some names. So I think we will see a great deal of procrastination like the one that we have been seeing for the past few months. Netanyahu is interested in his personal safety when it comes to his political career, political life, and I think that's why even the security, Israeli security forces that are not being able to end this military confrontation with the Palestinian factions in Gaza are now trying to, through the political means, to come to a, would say, honorable end for this, but they are failing to do so.
You're talking about Benny Gantz being in Washington now to meet with today Kamala Harris, Tony Blinken she'll be meeting with, and other officials. I wanted to finally ask you about the issue of famine, about the number of children who are dying of hunger and dehydration, and how the Palestinians are dealing with this at this point.
Thank you. Well, according to the statistics that were released by the Palestinian Minister of Health, around 1 million Palestinians have developed some diseases of any kind, be them some diseases that have to do with the digestive system, with the respiratory system, with the upper respiratory system, which is indicative of the quality of life, where quality of life has reached in Gaza. And what is the situation of the public health? When you don't have water desalination plants, when you destroy the water purification systems, when you destroy the solar panels that are on top of the houses of the people, when you destroy the heavy vehicles that are used by the municipalities to remove the waste, when you are destroying everything that has to do with the life of the Palestinians, this result is normal and is projected, and it will continue to deteriorate. Now with the children, 18 children have died in northern Gaza. More children are dying in southern Gaza. People cannot get decent food for their children. When people are drinking the water is polluted and it causes them some serious public health issues. And now the children are the most vulnerable people within the community. We have 1 million child in Gaza. 1 million child that do not have appropriate shelter, do not have appropriate feeding systems, they don't have appropriate water systems, and they end up consuming water that is polluted, food that is polluted. They end up exposed. The twin that were killed yesterday, they were just twins, they were children. They were killed with their father. So they were deprived from the right to live, and they are still deprived from the right to access decent water, shelter, and food supplies. So this is the situation in Gaza as it is. It is an ongoing suffering because of the fact that Israeli occupation denied them the right to be treated as humans. This is the whole issue.
Akram al-Safari, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Gaza-based journalist speaking to us today from Rafah. Please be safe.
That's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine. Thank you.
Prices on
this crazy